Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode number 101, Troilus and Cressida by William Shakespeare. Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. And this episode is in association with Dear Reader Season 3, brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we've both read and determine whether it is required reading. Here I am. I feel like I cannot call myself Cressida because apparently she's faithless, and that's how she is always known, and people are compared to her if they're faithless. And, you know, Tom is pretty steadfast. I could say that he's as faithful as or as steadfast as Troilus, so I don't really know which character I could potentially be. I could be Hector. But, yeah, here we are. Tom, welcome to Troy.
As if you're not Cassandra just running into the room and wailing and then leaving every once in a while.
That probably would be me. Yeah, no one listening to my wisdoms. Exactly. I could see that for sure. Yes. It's been a long time since we... I'm just kidding. It has been very recent since we talked about the Trojan War. What sorts of things have been going on in your life since last we spoke about Troy?
Just the usual day-to-day...
Yeah.
Stuff, trying to help navigate my child's senior year of high school. So that's, that's a challenge. But and the college stuff and stuff like that. But yeah, just trying to make it through every day. It's been a lot in the last couple of months. Have been a lot just in daily life. So, but you know,
it's a long push.
Yeah. Well, I like this. This always is. I mean, I know we put out a show and everything and all that, and we have our faithful listeners, but honestly, this is like to give credit to Shaq, us joy.
Joy situation.
Exactly.
I can appreciate that. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, yes, we are here to talk about another Shakespeare. Is this our fourth Shakespeare?
Let's see. We did Macbeth.
Yep.
Julius Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
Twelfth Night.
Mm-hmm.
So this is number five. Yeah.
Number five. Yes, and of course we don't really need to talk about the Bard because we've talked about him a great deal already, and there's a lot to talk about the background of this particular play. But what is your history with this play?
This is the first time I've ever read this play.
Mm-hmm.
My only history with the story, well, with half of the story, obviously my history with it concerns my history with the Iliad and the Trojan mm-hmm. War, because the plot takes place during, concurrently with the events of the Iliad. But the Troilus and Cressida narrative, I did experience or read not through Shakespeare, but through Geoffrey Chaucer in college. I remember I literally took a class about Chaucer and Troilus and Crusade, and I'm probably mispronouncing her name, in that one, or his poem of that, which I know is like one of the versions of their story, was one of the poems of Chaucer's that we had to read. I don't remember very much of it, though. It was a very long time ago. It was like 1998. So that's a while ago.
Yeah. And I personally had not known that this play existed. Yeah, it just sort of was not on my radar and had popped up as I was, of course, doing research for adaptations and saw an ad, really, or images from the Royal Shakespeare Company production of Troilus and Cressida. I'm like, what's this? And thought, you know, wouldn't it be lovely to do a Shakespeare play with my pal, Tom, and have a nice little crossover episode? And little did I know what was to befall me.
Yeah. Well, I get more mileage out of my wife's copy of the Norton Shakespeare, so at least keeping that around the house has been a good thing, and not just for shelf dressing in the living room. So.
Yeah, I know when guests come over and immediately go to your bookshelf to see if you're a learned man,
you can
be like, look, I've got the Norton edition of Shakespeare. And now you can say that you've read Troilus and Cressida.
We all do that, don't we? Like, back in college, it was like you go to your friend's dorm room and you'd start shuffling through their CDs.
Yeah.
You see what they had. And then, and like, I've been to people's houses and like, you know, you see books and like, I mean, I get distracted by things easily, but like you start looking at the books that they have and it's not even a judgment on them. You're just kind of like curious. It's like, you know, what do you have?
Yeah. I think some of us do that. I think if we have a preference for books, we are going to do that more so than other people. Because I don't know if Joe Schmo off the street is going to necessarily go and like, oh, what do you have on your bookshelf? But I do have a friend, Sam Heath, who immediately goes to somebody's shelf, which I feel like maybe bookshelves can tell you about the person's character. If they even have a bookshelf, that tells me a lot.
Yeah,
I actually think that it might be a red flag if someone doesn't have any books.
Mm-hmm. That's something that I've thought about in recent years, where like there are people out there who just don't own books and also don't read. Like, because, you know, you might not have a lot of books, but you might be a frequent user of your library, which you should be anyway. But yeah, there are people who they just don't read. And you're like, dang, I never. By the way, there is an entire subreddit where people post pictures of their bookshelves and the people comment on trying to figure out what this person is like.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't comment, but I will flip through the pictures just to see what books they have. And sometimes like it's like a room and I'm like, this living room or whatever room you're posting looks gorgeous. And I'm jealous of all this built-in bookshelves, like that sort of thing.
What if I posted a picture of my bookshelf with all of my smut and then the neon light that says smut? What do you think they would think of me? And then the Nightwing and Batgirl right above it. I'd have that one and then the learned one right next to it. And they'd be like, who is this person who's like schizophrenic?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the context of this book, because it's a bit nuts in what I have found out. I mean, a big question is like, where did this come from? Because if you've read the Iliad, you're probably wondering who the deuce is Cressida?
Yeah.
Troilus, what's going on here? So this is not, these people, you know, and this relationship do not appear in Greek legends. Mm-hmm. It was invented by the 12th century French poet Benoît de Saint-Maur in the Roman de Troyes. And it's derived from, or, well, Cressida's name is derived from Chryseis, who is, of course, kind of how the whole issue began, because she was wanted back by her father, and there was a plague, and then Agamemnon's upset and needed a new person. We do know Calchas, but this is interesting because Calchas, he was a Greek seer. He was with the Greeks the entire time. He's the one who said, oh, Agamemnon, you should sacrifice your daughter. But here it's that he's a traitor. He's a Trojan, and he goes over. So lots of things that have changed. So if you are concerned and confused, because I was thinking to myself, my gosh, I just read the Iliad, what's going on here? Just be aware that this is more of a Renaissance interpretation, and maybe medieval retelling of the Trojan War that from that moment has basically been captured in pop culture as well as other retellings, and she becomes the archetype of a faithless lover. So we can just talk about all the sexism in this particular, yeah, or misogyny, I think, you know, if we were to take it there. So just be aware, if you're concerned that you don't remember a Cressida, worry not.
Yeah. Is this kind of like a, I'm trying to think of a modern day equivalent, and I went to Jack and Rose on the Titanic. Oh. Like, it sounds like these were character, they're kind of based on old characters and stuff, but it's like, let's just make up a couple of characters to be central to a plot for this movie. Yeah. So that's what I was thinking of when I learned that, no, these weren't actual, like, you know, recorded Greek characters.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, because mm-hmm. My greatest criticism is revolving around what you have just said. The dating, it is a bit of a, it's crazy. I don't know what to even say. It's not really exactly known. They believe that has been written about around 1602. They're talking about different portfolios and where it may have landed with it. And so the quarto edition labels it as a history play, but the first folio classed it with the tragedy. So there's confusion about genre. It's just, it's a big old mess, I would say.
Yeah.
Just kind of looking up everything and people whose job it is and whose passion it is to figure out, you know, when things happen, when things have been written, when things are performed, they're also in a bit of a kerfuffle. Mm. Shakespeare drew on a number of sources for his plotline. Chaucer, as Tom had mentioned, and his version of the tale, yes, Troilus and Cresside, is one of them. John Lydgate's Troy book and Caxton's translation of the, oh boy, Recuyell of the Histories of Troy, all inspirations for Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
A 19th century literary critic named Frederick S. Boas argued that Troilus and Cressida deserves its own special category as quote-unquote problem play. Which was drawn from the socially conscious drama of playwrights contemporaneous with Boas, like Ibsen and Shaw, and describes a play centered on a social or political problem in such a way as to promote debate but not easy resolution. I also interpret problem play as another, you know, way, but we'll talk about that. Yet the deep sense of Troilus and Cressida, according to Dawson, Anthony B. Dawson, lies in its perplexity. He says, quote, it is still full of puzzles, but that fact has been recognized as a virtue rather than a defect. Its difficulties are generative, its obstacles fruitful. Jonathan Bale, who's a modern author, regards the play as a satire, deliberately undermining the heroic and romantic style of a new, at that time, and popular translation of Homer by George Chapman. He mentions the cynical attitude of Pandarus towards the overnight tryst arranged between the lovers and the weak, quote-unquote, feminine language of the supposedly valiant warriors. We'll talk about Thersites as well, mm-hmm. and how he is, what his purpose is in this particular play. So we don't know, you know, it's positioned between the histories and the tragedies in the first folio. Some believe that it was supposed to follow the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet. Just lots of things. Should it be slotted after the famous history of Henry VIII? You should go on Wikipedia and just see all the stuff that's going on here. If I were to briefly talk about the impact, above all, is this image of Cressida that really changed within the 16th century, that she is synonymous with infidelity and falsity, and Pindarus, her uncle, or cousin, I can't recall now off the top of my head, is used as a synonym now for procurers, because we get pander from that.
Pander, okay.
Yeah.
It's according to the dramatis personae in the Norton, Cressida is listed as his niece.
Okay.
Calchas is her father.
Within this adaptation, all the characters are unworthy of their legendary reputation, which we'll talk about. So the Hector that you expect is a bit different. I would say that he might be the least changed. Achilles, I think. Agamemnon is changed, like, in a positive way, in my opinion. Ajax is a brute, kind of a dumb brute. And Shakespeare doesn't intensify the negative tendencies of these characters, but links them. He superimposes contradictory characterizations in order to make them more interesting and so that the audience can access them more easily. But it seems like this play was actually not popular. It was unpopular. And that he was unsuccessful in this particular play. So it was composed around 1602, or so some say. It was probably staged between 1602 and 1603. There is a public record that says around this time. It's been suggested that the work was performed only once, and then the volume was just recommended for the libraries of the quote-unquote eternal reader. So I think that points to potentially its unpopularity and its lack of success. But even though throughout history I think performances were sparse, it has become more popular, and it's more popular and it resonates more often when the world is in conflict. Which, you know, makes sense. So, let's see, a couple times here. The Vietnam War. So, John Barton, he was preparing for a 1968 Royal Shakespeare Company production. He actually saw the parallels between the prolonged war in Vietnam and the stalemated siege of Troy as an offering a way into the script. And he said, quote, "The basic situation is ludicrous, but also an insoluble impasse where both sides are inexorably committed." He didn't reference this on stage, but the wars and the lechery of the play were shown in the context of the new sexual freedoms of the 1960s. And I know that there was another one. Yeah, in August of 2012, there is obviously stuff going on in the Middle East. And during the international production at the Swan Theater in Stratford, the depiction of Thersites as a wounded war veteran and the manner in which the Myrmidons killed Hector, quote, resonated with the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think it depends on when it's happening to determine success. So maybe at that time in 1602, maybe the people were a little too far removed from conflict that it didn't really resonate with them as much. And we'll talk about also in regards to their knowledge base of the Iliad itself. But yes, this I think that's very interesting. So other productions, the Royal Shakespeare Company, as I said, they had some really interesting actors, if I were just to go through. They've performed it several times. Peter O'Toole played Thersites in 1960. Helen Mirren played Cressida in 1968. Francesca Annis and John Nettles played Cressida and Thersites, respectively, in 1976. Juliet Stevenson and Alan Rickman played Cressida and Achilles, respectively, in 1985. Ralph Fiennes and Simon Russell Beale played Troilus and Thersites, respectively, in 1990. And Joseph Fiennes played Troilus in 1996. There's also a broadcast by the BBC of a modern language and modern dress version by Ian Dallas as The Face of Love in 1954, which was then staged by RADA, Royal Academy of Drama, at the Vanberg Theatre in 1956, with Albert Finney in his first stage role. The Public Theatre in New York City has produced three revivals, 1965, 1995, and 2016. And in 2009, the Hudson's Shakespeare Company of New Jersey presented a production as part of their annual Shakespeare in the Park series, where the director, John Ciccarelli, set the action in ancient Greece but sought to put a modern twist on the action by comparing the title pair to Romeo and Juliet, which I do have questions about, and posing the question, would their relationship have lasted if they had lived? So that's basically, yeah, giving some background as to context, confusion surrounding it, as well as the unpopularity, but it kind of depends on when it's performed. Are you surprised, or does it make sense that it resonates more in wartime than it does in peacetime?
When you put it like that, it does seem to make sense that it would resonate more in wartime than in peacetime, considering, you know, the take away the romantic side of the plot and you look at the war aspects of it, it is very much, you know, one of those things that can definitely reflect the current feeling or events and things like that. Yeah, so I can see that, like, this might not get across as much when you don't have a conflict going on and people aren't as interested in war during those times.
Oh, Tom, should I get into the plot synopsis?
Go right ahead.
Oh, here we go. Just for audience's sake, and we'll be talking about this, but there are two plots happening here. You've got Troilus, a Trojan prince, son of Priam, who is wooing Cressida, who is another Trojan. And in another one, we have a political plot that's going on that's not only between Troy and the Greeks, but also with the Greeks and Achilles. So just be aware of all of that. And as I go through this plot synopsis, you also will maybe think to yourself, huh, why is it called Troilus and Cressida? So here we go. Act 1, Scene 1. The play opens with a prologue, an actor dressed as a soldier who gives us the background to the plot, which takes place during the Trojan War, as we all know. Within the walls of Troy, Prince Troilus complains to Pandarus that he is unable to fight because of heartache. He is desperately in love with Pandarus's niece Cressida. Pandarus complains that he has been doing his best to further Troilus's pursuit of his niece and that he has received small thanks for his labors. After he departs, Troilus remarks that Pandarus has been growing irritable lately. Well, I wonder why, Troilus. As he ponders, the Trojan commander Aeneas comes in, bringing news that Paris has been wounded in combat with Menelaus. As the noise of battle comes in offstage, Troilus agrees to join his Trojan comrades on the field. And I just want to say that this happens year 7 of the Trojan War. I forgot to say that. Scene 2. In another part of the city, Cressida converses with her servant, who recounts how a Greek warrior named Ajax, a valiant but stupid man, managed to overcome the great Trojan prince Hector the previous day, and that Hector is fighting furiously because of this defeat. Cressida is joined by Pandarus, and they discuss the Trojan princes, with Pandarus taking the unlikely position that Troilus is a greater man than Hector. As they converse, several Trojan lords pass by them, returning from battle, including Antenor. Oh, I guess that's foreshadowing. Aeneas, Hector, and Paris. Pandarus praises each one, but tells his niece that none of them can match Troilus. He then leaves Cressida, promising to bring a token from Troilus. Alone, Cressida says that while she returns Troilus' feelings, she is holding him off. She is enjoying his pursuit of her. Scene 3. In the Greek camp, the great general and King Agamemnon is conversing with his lieutenants and fellow kings. He asks why they seem so glum and downcast, for although their 7-year siege of Troy has met little success so far, they should welcome the adversity, oh my, that the long war represents, since only in difficult times can greatness emerge. Nestor, the oldest of the Greek commanders, cites examples of how heroism emerges from hardship. In response, Ulysses expresses his deep respect for what they have said, but points out that the Greek army is facing a crisis, not because of the duration of the war, but because of a breakdown in authority within the Greek camp. Instead of being united, they are divided into factions. Achilles refuses to fight, and instead stays in his tent while Patroclus ridicules the Greek commanders. And Patroclus and Achilles have a sexual relationship here, just FYI. Others, like Ajax and his foul-mouthed slave, Thersites, follows this example, and so the entire army is corrupted. The others agree that this is a great problem, and as they discuss what is to be done, Aeneas appears under a flag of truce, bringing a challenge from Hector. The Trojan prince offers to fight any Greek lord in single combat, with the honor of their respective wives as the issue. The Greeks agree to find a champion and offer Aeneas hospitality. As Aeneas is led away, Ulysses tells Nestor that this challenge is truly directed at Achilles, since only Achilles could match the great Hector in battle. But to have Achilles fight Hector would be dangerous, because if Achilles lost, it would dishearten the entire army. Therefore, Ulysses suggests they should have Ajax fight Hector instead. Even if Ajax loses, they can still claim that Achilles would have won in his place. At the same time, by choosing Ajax as their champion, they will infuriate Achilles even more, and perhaps goad him into rejoining the war, bringing with him all his soldiers. Nestor, impressed with Ulysses' intelligence, agrees to the plan. Act 2, Scene 1. In the Greek camp, Ajax summons his slave Thersites. Thersites, and orders him to find out the nature of the proclamation that has just been posted. Thersites, a foul-mouthed ruffian, refuses to obey and instead curses his master and the Greeks with equal vigor, provoking Ajax to beat him. Achilles and Patroclus come upon them, and he includes them in his curses. Offended at Patroclus' request that he stop, he replies, quote, "I will hold my peace when Achilles' brooch bids me, shall I?" This term meaning in the 16th century.
It's a euphemism.
Yeah. I was just trying to figure out what this meant. Yes, that this brooch is a pointed rod, a spit, or a pricker, implying that Achilles and Patroclus were lovers. They send him away, and Achilles tells Ajax the news of Hector's challenge to any brave Greek warrior. The selection of the warrior has been put to a lottery otherwise. Achilles says as he leaves, he would have been the only possible choice, a remark that produces a sneer from Ajax. Scene 2. In Troy, King Priam and his sons debate the wisdom of continuing the war, when they can end it by returning Helen to the Greeks. Hector, supported by his brother Helenus, argues eloquently that while the theft of Helen may have been a brave act, she cannot be worth the great and bloody price they are paying to keep her. When he is done speaking, his sister Cassandra, a prophetess who is considered mad, dashes in and cries that if they do not let Helen go, Troy will burn. When she is gone, Troilus dismisses her warning as ravings and argues that they must keep Helen for the sake of their honor, and Paris supports him. Of course he's going to support him. Hector retorts that this is why young men cannot be trusted to make moral decisions, since passion overwhelms their reason. But Troilus says that Helen is more than a woman. She is a theme of honor and renown, and Hector yields and agrees to continue the war. He goes on to report the challenge that has been sent to the Greeks and how he hopes it will bring Achilles to the field. Scene 3. Alone, Thersites sneers at the pretensions of both Ajax and Achilles. When Patroclus and Achilles appear, he calls them fools. Patroclus moves to strike him, but Achilles holds him off. They see the Greek commanders Agamemnon, Ulysses, Nestor, and Diomedes approaching, accompanied by Ajax, and Achilles quickly retires to his tent. When Agamemnon asks to see him, Patroclus tells the general that Achilles is ill. Agamemnon grows angry, but Achilles refuses to emerge and tells Ulysses, who goes in to see him, that he still refuses to fight the Trojans. Agamemnon suggests that Ajax go in and plead with Achilles, but Ulysses declares that doing so would be insulting to Ajax, and then he, with the other Greek commanders, praises Ajax profusely, saying that he is the best of their warriors, while also, in asides, insulting him. They agree to leave Achilles in his tent and decide that Ajax will be their champion against Hector the next day. Act 3, Scene 1. In Troy, Pandarus converses with a servant while he waits to speak with Paris and Helen. When they come in, he compliments Helen profusely and asks her to excuse Troilus if Priam asks about him at dinner that night. Paris and Helen ask where Troilus will be dining, and Pedarus refuses to tell them, but they both guess that he will be in pursuit of Cressida, and they make bawdy jokes about it as they depart to greet the returning warriors. Scene 2. Pandarus finds Troilus pacing about impatiently in an orchard and assures him that his desire for Cressida will soon be satisfied. He goes out, leaving Troilus giddy with expectation, and brings in Cressida. After urging them to embrace, Pandarus departs. Left alone, they profess their love for one another, and each pledges to be faithful to the other. Troilus reassures Cressida and again pledges to be faithful, declaring that thereafter history will say of all lovers that they were as true as Troilus. Cressida declares that if she ever strays from him, she hopes that people will say of false lovers that they were as false as Cressida. Pandarus declares that if ever the pair prove false, may all pitiful goers between be called after his name. Which, there you go. Scene 3. Meanwhile, in the Greek encampment, Cressida's father Calchas, who has betrayed Troy in order to join the Greeks, asks a Greek general to grant him a favor. He asks that they exchange the Trojan commander Antenor for his daughter so that he might be reunited with her. Agamemnon agrees and orders Diomedes to supervise the exchange. On Ulysses' advice, the Greek commanders then file past Achilles' tent and scorn the proud warrior, ignoring his greetings and making him uneasy. He goes to Ulysses and asks him why he's being scorned or shunned, and Ulysses tells him that he is no longer a hero and he will be forgotten quickly. Ah, shame tactic. He tells and suggests that Achilles could restore his fame and honor if he stopped dallying with enemy women and took the field. I was trying to think of what her name is. Polyxena. Apparently he's having an affair with her or has a crush on her. When Ulysses is gone, Patroclus tells Achilles to follow Ulysses' advice. Seeing that his reputation is at stake, Achilles agrees. Thersites comes in and reports that Ajax is now striding about the camp, completely puffed up with his own importance. Patroclus persuades the foul-mouthed slave to talk Ajax into bringing Hector, safely conducted by Agamemnon, to Achilles' tent after their fight the next day. That's assuming that either of them will be alive, so that Achilles may speak with Hector. Act 4, Scene 1. Diomedes comes to Troy to make the exchange of Antenor for Cressida, and he is greeted heartily by Aeneas and Paris. Aeneas goes to fetch Cressida, remarking that this exchange will deal a heavy blow to Troilus. Paris concurs, but says regretfully that they have no choice. Quote, "The bitter disposition of the time will have it so," end quote. After Aeneas is gone, Diomedes is asked who he thinks deserves Helen more, Paris or Menelaus. With great bitterness, the Greek replies that both deserve her, since both are fools, willing to pay a great price in blood for a whore. Scenes 2 through 3. Meanwhile, as morning breaks, Troilus takes a regretful leave of Cressida while she pleads with him to stay a little longer. Pandarus comes in and makes several bawdy jokes about the recent lovemaking, which is awkward since that's her uncle. Suddenly, there is a knock at the door and Cressida hides Troilus in her bedroom. Okay. Aeneas enters and demands that Pandarus fetch Troilus. When the young prince emerges, Aeneas tells him the sad news that Cressida must be sent to her father in the Greek camp. Troilus is distraught and goes with Aeneas to see his father, Priam, while Pandarus breaks the news to Cressida, who begins to weep. Scene 4. Troilus brings Diomedes, together with the great lords of Troy, to Cressida's house and begs leave to say goodbye to his lady. When they are alone, he pledges to be faithful, and Cressida promises that even in the Greek camp, she will remain true to him. Then Diomedes is brought in, and Troilus demands that he, quote, "use her well, for, by the dreadful Pluto, if thou dost not, thou, the great bulk Achilles, be thy guard, I'll cut thy throat," end quote. Diomedes retorts that he will make no promises, but will treat Cressida as she deserves. Yeek! Not because any Trojan prince orders him to. At that moment, a trumpet sounds, calling them all to the Greek camp for the duel between Hector and Ajax. Scene 5. In the Greek camp, the newly arrived Cressida is greeted by all the Greek commanders, Ulysses. Ulysses insists that she be kissed by everyone, only then refusing to kiss her himself, and when she is gone, he declares that she is a loose, unvirtuous woman. Then the Trojan lords arrive, and the conditions of the duel are set by Aeneas, who remarks that since Ajax and Hector are related, Hector's whole heart will not be in this fight. As the two combatants prepare, Agamemnon asks Ulysses, quote, what Trojan is that same that looks so heavy, end quote. Ulysses tells his general that the downcast Trojan is Troilus, and then goes on to praise him profusely, saying that Troilus may even be a greater man than Hector. And I did do some family tree research, and they are distantly related. I'm assuming this is Ajax the Greater rather than Ajax the Lesser, but I did look at their family tree. And finally, Act 5, Scene 1. Achilles boasts to Patroclus how he will kill Hector. The two encounter Thersites, who delivers a letter to Achilles and then unloads his usual torrent of abuse on them, calling Patroclus Achilles' male varlet, his masculine whore, and on the entire campaign. The letter is from the Trojan princess, Polyxena, whom Achilles loves, and it begs him not to fight the next day. He tells Patroclus sadly that he must obey her wishes. They go out and Thersites remains. He watches from the shadows as the feast breaks up. Most of the lords go to bed, but Diomedes slips off to see Cressida, and Ulysses and Troilus follow him. Noting that Diomedes is an untrustworthy, lustful rogue, Thersites follows him as well. Scene 2. At Calchas' tent, Diomedes calls to Cressida. Her father fetches her while Troilus and Ulysses watch from one hiding place and Thersites from another. With Thersites' profanity and Troilus' shock providing a counterpoint, Diomedes woos Cressida, who behaves reluctantly but coyly toward his advances, fending him off for a time but never allowing him to leave. Eventually, she gives him a sleeve that Troilus presented to her as a love token. Then she takes it back and says that she never wants to see Diomedes again, but then softens, gives it to him once more, promises to wait for him later when he will come to sleep with her. When she is gone and Diomedes too, Troilus is in agony, first denying the evidence seen with his own eyes and then pledging to find Diomedes on the field of battle and kill him. Finally, as morning nears, Aeneas arrives to lead him back to Troy. Scene 3. Hector girds for battle while the women, i.e. his wife Andromache and his sister Cassandra, plead with him not to go, so very similar to the source material. Both have had dreams that prophesy his death, but he dismisses their warnings. Troilus comes in and says that he will be fighting too. Indeed, he chides Hector for having been too merciful to his enemies in the past, saying that today Troilus plans to slay as many men as he can. Cassandra leads Priam in, and the old king pleads with his son not to fight, saying that he too feels foreboding about this day. But Hector refuses to listen and goes out to the battlefield. Pandarus brings Troilus a letter from Cressida. Troilus tears it up, doesn't even read it, and follows Hector out to the field. Scene 4, as the battle rages, Thersites wanders in the field, escaping death by a brazen coward. Brazen cowardice. Scene 5, another part of the plains, Agamemnon summarizes the ways the Greeks are doing badly in the battle, including that Dorieus is taken prisoner and Patroclus probably slain. Then Nestor enters and says that, quote, there is 1,000 Hectors in the field, end quote. The scene ends with Achilles asking where Hector is. Scene 6, Troilus calls Diomedes a traitor for capturing his horse. Diomedes, Ajax, and Troilus exit fighting. Hector spares the unprepared Achilles, who boasts that Hector was simply fortunate to find him unarmed. Hector sees a Greek in ornate armor and pursues him. Scene 7, in another part of the plains, Menelaus and Paris enter the scene fighting. Thersites is confronted by a bastard son of Priam, but declares that as he is himself a bastard, they have no business fighting each other. I'm sure that's a fallacy somewhere. Scene 8, Achilles and his men find Hector, who has finished fighting and taking off his armor in order to try on the golden armor of the warrior he has conquered. Surrounding the unarmed Trojan, they stab him to death in the stupidest scene I've ever read, that Hector would never do this. They just grab the armor and take it with them. They don't just start to strip themselves in the middle of the battle. It was nuts.
And that's not what happens in the Iliad, no. From what I recall, right?
No. Okay. Not at all. Scene 9, Agamemnon, Ajax, Menelaus, Nestor, Diomedes, and others enter marching. Word spread among the Greeks of the death of Hector. And finally, Scene 10, an embittered Troilus informs the Trojans of Hector's death and curses Pandarus. Left alone on the stage, the unhappy Pandarus wonders why he should be so abused when his services were so eagerly desired only a little while before. The end. Tom, did you like Troilus and Cressida?
Not really. I'm not going to sit here and complain that I hated it. I mean, it's took a couple of days for me to get through it, and I was listening to it while reading it. Lots of long, long, long speeches when you get into the Greek camp with Achilles and Ulysses, et cetera, et cetera. The Troilus and Cressida storyline was probably the better part of it for me. It was the more interesting thing. But yeah, this is like deep cut Shakespeare. This is not something that, you know, like if you just want to read some Shakespeare that you even pull out, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm going to give it a pass.
Yeah, I did not like this. I won't say I hated it, but I really did not like it. Mm-hmm. I felt bad. I felt bad immediately. There are some things I recommend that I think I'm not sure if Tom will like this. But it'll be okay. And, you know, everyone likes their own thing. But once I started reading this, I thought, I now regret, you know, asking Tom to read this because we have limited time. And then I made you read something. I honestly, like, I'm not a Shakespeare scholar, but I don't think it's good. I you know, we talked about, I said about the problem play. Like, I interpreted that as in, like, yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem play. Not just this whole thing. It just felt like a mishigosh. The whole history about the play is almost, like, symbolic of what's going on in here. Mm-hmm. And then just not liking the characters and the characterizations at all. And, of course, this is an adaptation. It is an interpretation. But I just feel like Shakespeare does not do justice to some of, you know, the great characters in literature. And then I'm just confused why it's called Troilus and Cressida, which is one of my things. I also had trouble with the language. It got better for me. I would say maybe once I hit like the latter part of Act 2 or Act 3. But the beginning was slow going for me. And I was struggling with this probably more than I ever have with any of the Shakespeare plays. I texted and messaged you. I was like, Tom, is it just me? Mm-hmm. It feels like a different, it's hard. I would love to talk to a Shakespeare scholar about this particular play, but I did not like it, and I honestly don't think that it's any good. I'm glad that there are people out there that do think it's good, but if I were in the 1600s, I probably would have been disappointed with my play watching as well and wouldn't have gone back again.
Yeah, they can't all be hits, I guess.
They can't all be hits. That's true. That is true. Yeah, I think this is the first Shakespeare play that I haven't enjoyed.
Yeah.
So that's good. Of all the ones I've read, that's a high percentage. I just want to get this out of the way. Why is this the title of the play? Why is it Troilus and Cressida? Because we see them for the first time together. Act 3, Scene 2.
Yeah.
And then the next time we see them is also the last time we see them, really, which is Act 4, Scene 4.
I can only think of you had asked if this is a rehash of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking marketing that maybe Troilus and Cressida was a known story, or the play Romeo and Juliet would work really well. So let's have another pair of lovers in the title of the play. Kind of like how Marcus Brutus is pretty much the main character of Julius Caesar, yet it's the tragedy of Julius mm-hmm. Caesar, because the tragedy of Marcus Brutus is not going to sell as many tickets. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think. It's like, I think it's just, maybe it was a better selling point than, I don't know, the history of the Trojan War or something, you know, or whatever. I mean, that's the only way I can think of it, because it's barely in, they're barely in the play.
Yeah.
Like, they are a subplot of their own play.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you think this play is actually about?
I'm gonna compare it to a movie like a Titanic or a mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor, where it is a history movie, but the writer, in this case Shakespeare, or the director or whatever, felt they needed to put like a humanistic or some sort of human aspect into it, so they created characters who could have a love story in the midst of this war. But I think I'm looking at it through a modern, like, cinematic lens that way, and it might not be totally correct.
No, I can definitely see that. It's interesting you talk about marketing, and I feel like back then, who wouldn't be excited to go see something about the Trojan mm-hmm. War, or if you titled something like The Wrath of Achilles or something.
Yeah, that would have worked.
But yeah, here we have these two people, and I personally, I don't care about either of them.
No.
We barely see them, and unlike Romeo and Juliet, you know, we don't really clamor for them to get together. I mean, I'll speak mm-hmm. for myself. I know that you might not necessarily. The friar cannot be compared to Bendaris, or no. I guess flip it around. But yeah, for me, it's just it is about this political drama that's not only happening between Troy and Greece, but also within the Greek camp, and well, I guess you could say within Troy, but I feel like we spend way more time in the Greek camp than we do at Troy. I feel like it's at least 60-40 split if I were to put something in there.
Yeah.
But it's just so confused because I went in there thinking, oh, wow, this is really interesting. If you have like a little like publisher synopsis, it would basically just be about, you know, these two Trojans that fall in love, and then one of them is, and then their love is tested because one of them is sent to the Greek side. And I'm like, wow, that's really compelling. What is this going to be like? And I'm like, this is not compelling.
There was no struggle.
There was no struggle on Cressida's side. I'm struggling with the representation of women in mm-hmm. in this play. And I feel like Shakespeare has had, like, it's touch and go. There are some great characters. There are some not great. I should specify female characters.
Yeah.
I feel like he's got some really strong female characters. But this is like, what? So I can't even decide. I mean, would you consider this a sexist play or a misogynist play?
It is a bit sexist because the female characters are portrayed as either crazy,
yeah,
or unfaithful, or I mean, there's a fair amount of forgive the phrase slut shaming going right. on in yeah. here, right? Because Cressida is portrayed as this kind of floozy, like, you know, like she just kind of and it must have been pretty, I want to say this was titillating in a sense, because he beds her and they're not married
mm-hmm.
when you have a number of other story, you know, which is kind of like, you know, that's a little bit, might be a little bit controversial, yet he did have, it's not like every character that he showed having sex with another character was married. I mean, A Midsummer Night's Dream alone is just like a bunch of people having sex in the woods, but but that's a comedy, right? Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be farcical and silly. This is, I don't know what he's going for here, and I don't think that the sex outside of marriage has anything to do with it. It was just kind of like, he sets her up as, I'm going to be faithful to you. And you're right. You're looking at this. Is this love going to survive this war? And there's some real chance for like heartache and mm-hmm. melancholy and, you know, et cetera. And she turns around and is just like, Diomedes is like, hey, baby. And she's like, hoo, hoo, hoo. And then she basically, okay, let's go. And Troilus is like, I can't believe this. And the other person who gets slut-shamed quite a bit is Helen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, that you read the line about, you know, her being a whore. There's also the fact that she's like really, she seems to have no problem with Paris.
No.
Like they seem to be like a couple here. Whereas in the Iliad and in other ways I've seen her portrayed, she is at best reluctant to be at his side, but for the most part is like essentially tortured, not physically tortured, but like, you know, just emotionally tortured over the fact that she cannot be with her husband and such. So yeah, it's not like he's never had questionable portrayals of female characters. We can have a whole conversation about that if we ever decide to talk about the Taming of the Shrew, right?
Yeah.
Because especially the end of that play where you're like, how do you play this? You know, Petruchio gaslights her, like literally, no, not like overusing the word gaslighting. He's literally gaslighting her through parts of it. What are we supposed to get out of that? And here I'm just kind of like, and it ends like that too. It's not like he ever has a real moment to try to woo her back or has a confrontation with her. It's just kind of like some, if he's going for a soap opera type of thing, it doesn't land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, as you were talking about it, and I'm just going to, I think, you know, we try to avoid, I think, pejoratives on this show.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think we just need to name the thing because that is the language that Shakespeare is using. He is using the word whore. So I think we're going to address that just, you know, directly. I think about the epic poets and everything. And as you know, because you teach the Odyssey every year, that really you're either one or the other in terms of women. You know, you're either the doting wife or the temptress or seductress or goddess and things like that.
And the Odyssey is a great like, example of that.
Yeah, we get that here. But the woman who is long-suffering and at home is like Penelope is a great, you know, model potentially of a woman, especially, you know, at that time. But here it's like I don't even – maybe Andromache is like a positive model, but it really is like it's either the whore or the crazy person because even – and I think Andromache is sort of put into that latter category because she has this foreboding feeling. But then, I mean, the only positive is that Priam also says like, I have a bad feeling. But because Andromache and Cassandra are placed – together, both talking to Hector about it. So there's like no positive female representation in this particular play.
Yeah, because even when you read the Odyssey, the character of Penelope has more than one dimension to her, because not only is she the doting wife, but she is yet another woman in that epic who's a trickster character, but she's doing it in a way that's thought of as virtuous or positive because she's tricking the suitor so she can stay faithful to her husband. You know, we can one day we'll read the Odyssey. We'll have a whole conversation about that. But yeah, where's the virtuous woman in this story?
Yeah. Non-existent. And there's no, because we have this political plot, I would expect there to be some tension with the love affair. Because now, I mean, basically Cressida is, I guess she's not a captive over there, even though she was traded. But, man, you expect her to maybe put up more of a fight. But almost immediately, which is what I was expecting, because from that publisher synopsis. But immediately you have this really bizarre scene of her kissing all of these generals at the prompting of Ulysses. And then Ulysses saying, no, not me, but that proves my point that you're a loose woman.
Yeah.
And why Cressida is acting the way she is. And I think that it's, which is why the genre like is very confusing too. Like, is this a comment? Is it a satire? Because in no way would a woman be having a fun time in this war camp. And Helen, however nice it is to see that maybe she's having an okay time now with Paris, she is, I really don't think that she was having a good time, especially given that one quote that, yeah, she has caused a lot of, or, you know, because of, quote unquote, her, there's a lot of people dead. I mean, she's not a fool. I think she recognizes this. So it's just like these women are like blasé at the current situation. It's like very confusing for me. Like, I don't understand why Shakespeare would choose to make his characters like this.
I'm sitting here thinking about this. I'm like, what would motivate him to write this or put all these things in? And again, I'm not a scholar of the Bard. So somebody listening to this is going to like be like, you know, you're wrong about this. And I will gladly accept that. You know, I literally teach two plays every year.
Yeah.
But I wonder if like he really wanted to do something with the Trojan War, like had an interest in it or the story, and he thought he could write all of his usual tricks and tropes in the context of this setting.
Mm.
like that he could do the cheeky satirical thing. He could do the love story. It's like he's trying, it's like he's almost trying to put too much in here. It's like a kitchen sink type of situation.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work. So maybe that's what was going on. Like he was throwing everything at the play to see what would stick, and nothing really did.
Yeah, which is why really Mishigosh, I think, is a pretty good definition. And like speaking of that with Pauly Zena, like if we wanted to do something, like why not have that, I'm disgusted with myself for saying like multiple times in a row, but why not have something central with Achilles? Mm-hmm. Maybe his struggle, and he's got a crush on, you know, Pauly Zena, and what that is like to be this quote unquote the best of Greeks and the Greek side, and then pining after a Trojan. That would be compelling for me, but instead of, you know, what happens here.
Yeah, well, and you have the it's interesting too, is like what's your take on Patroclus and Achilles in this play, where they're referring, is Shakespeare deliberately showing us queer characters, or is he being homophobic?
Yeah,
because he clearly shows that Patroclus and Achilles are, you know, have feelings for one another at best, right? You know, but then he has other characters basically call them, you know, the F word,
right.
You know, and it's like, I don't know. I don't expect that from him.
Yeah. I can almost imagine on play that you just have this kind of foppish, flamboyant character who doesn't look like a soldier. I don't know that I necessarily perceive any positive relationships or messaging from their love affair. Why do you think he chose year 7 of the Trojan War?
I was always under the impression that the Iliad took place in year 9, but maybe I was just mistaken.
It's the last bit of year 10.
Oh, it is. Yeah, so it is, because the Trojan War lasts 10 years and it ends with the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not too long after the events of the Iliad.
Correct.
Achilles has to die at some point. That's about it, right? Because Paris kills Achilles, but then they have the Trojan War. Yeah, I don't know why he chose year 7. Because it doesn't really make sense if you know the Iliad.
The only thing I could think is, I know, especially, this is like revisionist history.
Yeah.
The only thing I could think is that there are, like, the attitudes are maybe a little more positive than they would be in year 10 when everyone would be like, we need to finish this war. But even Agamemnon's speech that, hey, you know, through adversity, we're going to show our honor and our bravery. Like, he's a very positive character compared to normal. That's the only thing I could think, is that, you know, it's long, but it's not as long as 10. So we have more spirits that are mid-high. I won't say high, but, you know, higher than you would expect in a war. But otherwise, I have no idea.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. The different characters, are there any that jumped out at you as being perhaps similar or vastly different from the source material?
Your point about Ajax was a really good one. Achilles kind of seems like Shakespeare is trying to be at least a little bit accurate with him, because he does spend a good portion of the Iliad whining in his tent.
Mm-hmm.
Ulysses, I'm trying to remember what Ulysses is like in the Iliad, because my experience with him is through the Odyssey, in which he's, you know, he is arrogant, and that's like the lesson he has to learn. The sneakiness makes sense. I felt the scene where you were describing how he shames Achilles and all that actually tracks, because if you know how Achilles actually finally gets to go to war to begin with, is that his mother hides him among the women because Achilles is effeminate looking enough to pass as a woman.
Yep.
It's Odysseus who susses him out.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, do you know how Odysseus got convinced to go to the war?
Yeah, because he put his son. Well, no. Well, he pretended to be insane, and
yeah,
then,
and Agamemnon put his son to Telemachus in the way of the thing. So it's just like, you know, it's kind of a bit of irony there. But yeah, no. So that tracks. The others, I'm going to defer to you because there's so many different Greeks in the Iliad that like I can keep track of a number of them. Probably Hector. I would imagine Hector kind of comes off as the same sort of person, and they definitely, Cassandra is definitely ignored, I can tell you that. So
yes.
And then, and you know my issues with the portrayal of Helen here, so.
Yes, yeah, listen, Troilus, no one is as good as or better than Hector on the Trojan side, and that's even true, like, I love that Aeneas is in this. I would say he comes close, but there's no way that someone should be compared to Hector. And I know that was all to get Cressida to like swoon over him and everything, but that's just ridiculous. I would say Hector is pretty close. I think just whatever foolishness he got into in regards to taking his armor off and setting it, like when he's in battle, that was nuts. I can't get over that.
That was weird.
Him wanting to end the war by trading Helen. I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I could see it because he's thinking about the city and his father. Mm-hmm. We know that Troy is sort of his foremost thought. But at the other hand, he is one of the few people that treats women well in the source material. And I feel like he would protect her and keep her, and sort of what's done is done. Like, they're not going to get back any of the dead people anyway, so you might as well just kind of finish what's going on. Paris is a bit better, I think, than the source material. He seems to maybe be less whiny. Aeneas, in terms of, like, if we were to compare it to the Aeneid, I felt like he was pretty good. On the Greek side, Agamemnon is way more positive a representation than in the source material, because I feel like he's a poor example of leadership in the source material. But here he's like trying to really give his men some morale boosting, and he listens to other people and their counsel better. And he's not doing his little shame tactic of pretending that they're going to leave and they actually don't leave. So I felt like that was good. Ajax is a departure. I think Nestor is spot on. Ulysses, I think he is as clever as he normally is. He's a bit diabolical. We'll talk about who the antagonist might be. Could it be Ulysses? I don't know. Achilles is more or less... Yeah, he doesn't, I don't know if his wrath, I didn't feel his wrath as much as I did in the Iliad. And I will say that the Greek army and the Greek leadership have more of a backbone. The fact that they even shun Achilles, because they were kind of kowtowing to him the entire time trying to get him back.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really happen here. And where's Briseis, by the way? She's not even in this play. Yeah, so more or less... Do you feel like if you were an audience member in 1602 that you would have enough background knowledge in order to appreciate this play? If you never read the Iliad, would you be okay reading this play?
Maybe among the educated people. I can't attest to how well this legend was known among the groundling types, because they were very widely speaking uneducated, right? So... I don't know. I don't know if it was a tale told the same way that we tell a Cinderella or other stories that are kind of like, you know, told in that sense, or if it was something that, you know, the more well-read would have known.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he does a good job then, if they weren't well-read, that he makes it understood what's happening?
When you get to those parts that have a good amount of action to them, yes. Mm-hmm. Like when you act five, I think act five is one of the, despite some of the weird scenes, like Hector taking off the armor like that, because I was just like, what's going on here? Act five is probably one of the better acts of the play, because it moves so quickly. and he does cut between different parts of the battlefield because he has to manage what is a huge set piece, so to speak, right? It's not like Act 5 of Romeo and Juliet, where it's all taking place in one tomb and there's a couple of characters who come in and out. This isn't a massive... This is your Lawrence of Arabia, Ben-Hur, like those epic... This would be an epic movie, right? Mm-hmm. So he does a fairly good job of getting all the pieces in place and shown for that particular battle. Some of the scenes, you know, but it drags so much. I guess people would kind of figure out who's who and what their characters are like, but even then I was just, I'm trying to find something positive to say here, but it just, like I said, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. I think you have to have some base knowledge because mm-hmm. otherwise you would think, why is Achilles in his tent? Why isn't Achilles fighting? That's I think the biggest thing. And maybe trying to figure out like about Patroclus and Achilles and why Achilles would suddenly start fighting after Patroclus was dead, who Helen was. So there definitely seems to be some base knowledge because he's not getting into all that.
Well, and that comes really quickly, by the way, too. Patroclus and then all of a sudden Achilles, it seems to happen like in the midst of the battle.
Yeah.
Whereas I remember it happening between, like, there was a between the battles with this in the Iliad. But again.
Well, yeah, because they were fighting over his body. Is that what you mean by in between the battle?
Yeah. And then he finally dons the armor. So I would assume that maybe you knew who Helen was.
Yeah. Hopefully, as sort of a pop culture icon at that point in time.
Yes,
which then Cressida becomes that particular person for some reason.
Yes.
Yeah, the end, I just feel like Shakespeare like ran out of steam, and he's like, I better do all these battles really quickly and kill off a bunch of people, because mm-hmm. all of a sudden, man alive, like even in my synopsis, you have these four acts that are like substantial conversation is happening, and then all of a sudden the fifth act is like, he's letting loose with all these fights and people dying, which is interesting, but also feels like he was rushing to finish it up.
Yeah, well, and there's not like there's a climactic moment, but it doesn't feel bombastically climactic. You know, like, I don't know, like the death of Hector is a climactic moment of the Iliad, and it's just I don't know, like it said, it kind of falls flat.
Yeah.
In a way, and I get what he's going for here, but it's almost like he didn't do enough tension and build up to this battle mm-hmm. in prior acts.
Yeah,
and maybe the Troilus and Cressida plot was actually a distraction, because mm-hmm. you know who like really really cares. You know, like it's just kind of like you're looking at like what does this have to do with everything else? And true. Troilus is on the battlefield and stuff like that, but it looks like he survives the play, right?
Yeah.
So again, like, is this a tragedy? Is this a comedy? Is it a satire? Yeah, it is. This is where it just gets very, very hard to figure out.
Yeah, and some unrealistic stuff, which I have some questions about. That is, you know, Troilus fighting Diomedes when Diomedes is sort of the one that Aeneas constantly goes up against, mm-hmm. and Aeneas, I would say, kind of second to Hector in prowess, and Troilus is probably pretty young compared to everybody else, and I just think that this is like this kid would have been slaughtered.
Well, because Diomedes, if I recall the Iliad correctly, seemed to be kind of on the level of Aeneas, because he seemed to be the second best warrior in the Greek camp, at least while, because he's going up against a bunch of people while Achilles is crying in his tent.
Yep.
And I see how you would put Troilus up against Diomedes in the context of the jilted lover.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it goes nowhere.
Yeah. Speaking of realism, do you feel like it's realistic how many times people from the opposite side are going to the other camp?
No. Because it's in some cases it seems like yes, because they are trying to negotiate in some way or another, and I totally get that. But other times it's like they're paying a visit.
That is like, what it feels like.
They're just stopping by.
They are inside. Yeah, Diomedes is fully inside Troy.
Yeah.
Aeneas is like given a meal. Hector? What? Like the fight happens, like, well, you know, if he lives, come on and bring him into Achilles' camp and let's have a meal. Like, what play is this? This is not going to happen. The Greeks hate the Trojans.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, granted, the Greek concept of xenia, right?
Yeah.
And so when they're giving them meals, that tracks because xenia was very, very important.
Yeah.
But you're also right. Like, why are they visiting in like bros?
Yeah.
At different point, like at one point, I think Ulysses is like counseling Troilus.
Mistaken. Because he brings him to overlook the scene between Diomedes and Cressida.
Yeah.
But I just think if you think to the source material, the fact that Priam had to sneak out of Troy and sneak into the Greek camp in order to plead with Achilles to get his body back. This is not. You don't just walk across a battlefield. Like, someone's going to kill a Trojan
yeah,
if
yeah.
they see them. So I just felt like this was crazy. Crazy pants.
Yeah. I mean, to this day, the generals or the heads of those warring factions have to have a arranged meeting mm-hmm. at a neutral site for negotiations.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Why make Ulysses the main focal point for the Greeks, do you think? And perhaps a play.
I don't know. Maybe he is one of the most well-known. Achilles and Ulysses are probably two of the most well-known characters out of all of these.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's part of it, is there's an appeal to seeing him. I did have a sub-question. Why Ulysses?
Yeah, not Odysseus.
Well, not Odysseus. And is this, I don't know if this is a cultural thing that somebody can explain to me, because Ulysses gets used a lot across time when that's the Roman name.
Mm-hmm.
And the Roman gods are mentioned, because Jove and some yeah. others are yeah. mentioned as well. And so I don't know if it's the Roman influence on Britannia, you know, et cetera. Or what, but the Greek names don't seem to be in place here unless they just match up with the Romans.
Yeah.
So what's your take on that?
If only maybe at that time, considering the Renaissance, that mm-hmm. Perhaps the Latin/Italian/Roman would have been more ideal. That language
okay.
and,
that makes
and
sense.
That culture. That's the only,
yeah.
that's
no,
the
that makes sense.
I have. Yeah.
But I guess, you know, people know who Ulysses is. They know the character. Perhaps they know the character via the Odyssey and other stories. Mm-hmm. So having him be there and be like kind of a big part of it, that might be part of the appeal. What do you think?
Yeah. So being well known, perhaps he had to come up with Shakespeare, had to use someone who could be clever. Be kind of a spy master, be someone who is manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like maybe Odysseus is the only one who had those.
You said Odysseus, you know, that's Odysseus.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the only thing I could potentially think, because otherwise I'm not seeing it from, maybe you could do it with Agamemnon, but because Ulysses is so well known mm-hmm. as someone who is up to tricks
yeah.
and that his patron goddess is, you know, of wisdom and helps him with these tricks, I feel like that might be the reason why.
Yeah, no, Agamemnon's the general,
mm-hmm.
right? He's the leader. He's the Eisenhower. And so he would not be the one up to the tricks. So yeah, and Ulysses is known for it. You're right. He's the one who created the Trojan horse idea in the Iliad. He and I can't remember who he goes with, they go on that night raid and sneak
yes.
in and steal secrets and stuff like that. So he is a well-established character like that.
Mm-hmm.
My name is No Man, you know, that sort of thing.
Do you think there's a villain or antagonist of this play? Could it be Ulysses?
I guess it depends on what we think his purpose is for bringing Troilus over to see, witness what happens between Diomedes and Cressida. Is he trying to anger the kid? Is he doing it to rub it in his face? Is he doing it out of sympathy?
Mm.
I wasn't entirely sure, and I might have missed the point on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he is because he's scheming, but he's not in the play enough in a solo capacity for us to really see it. So maybe there is no villain in the play. There are antagonists, but I don't think there's a clear villain in the same way that Tybalt is a bit villainous, right? He's a bully. Macbeth is a villain in his own play, right? You know, and there's Brutus, he's a tragic hero because he is doing the right thing, or he thinks he's doing the right thing, and his own hubris gets the better of him. And Antony is seen as a hero too, so it's a, you know, so there's the tragedy, right? It's mm-hmm. a fallen hero. But here, no, there's no real villain, and there's not even really a fallen hero either. Maybe Hector is the fallen hero, but that's kind of a straightforward one, not a tragic yeah. hero in the making you pay for your mistake type of tragic hero.
Yeah, since it ends with Hector, yeah, Troy was saying Hector's dead.
Yeah,
everyone going through that. Yeah, unless to be, I don't know what the word would be, but if war is the villain, you know, that
possibly.
Everyone can sign, kind of agree upon, because all of this stuff wouldn't have happened if there weren't a war, with the exception of Helen being yeah. stolen by Paris.
Is he making a commentary on war through this play, though? You know, like a war is hell, or war is wrong, or we lose so many people to war?
Not enough, I think, because it's only really spoken of in terms of, like, Helen.
Yeah.
That they've lost so many people. And, you know, with Agamemnon's speech, however morale boosting it might be, the fact that it's sort of pro-war, like we should go to war in order to prove our mettle and to prove that we're manly men, and
yeah.
you know, that we have honor and virtue. So I don't know that it's necessarily anti-war. Do you feel like I think we've answered this about balancing the political
yeah.
and romantic
yeah.
plots. We don't think that he did. Is it realistic, another question of this, that Cressida is an equal barter with Antenor?
I get the motivation for her father to be the one, you know, her father's the one who proposes the deal, more or less. He wants his daughter with him. I get that. I don't know if that's of much of an exchange, though. It is kind of weird. It does serve the plot, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, I would say no. Not that she's, well, part of it is like you're trading a lieutenant for a woman.
Yeah.
I'll be blunt about that. Like, that does not seem as if it were a good trait. You could potentially get, if anything, Helen might be equal with Antenor, if it's that serious, because they make him out to be this guy like that Troy's going to lose without.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just seems like, I don't know, Agamemnon in no way would agree with his barter. I don't know. Calchas is really, he's shifty or so persuasive in order to say, hey, could I have my daughter with me? And let's give back this Trojan captive. I'm actually surprised that they've kept him as a prisoner of war. But then I did some thinking. I thought, well, maybe. They would probably have prisoners of war. But there's so much slaughter in the Iliad that I kind of forget that people are alive at all.
Yeah,
but this is probably,
true.
As a bargaining chip, he probably would be used. But it's just not something that I would have thought of. Because you kind of have to think, what can we get out of it? And what exactly does Cressida bring to the Greeks?
Yeah, this is a classic case of because the plot demands it.
Yeah.
You know, we got to get her over there somehow so she can cheat on Troilus with Diomedes.
Yeah, it would have been more compelling had she been like a war captive, that she were in, I don't know, a temple like Chryseis or something.
Yeah.
And then she was stolen. Like, that would have been, I think, more compelling. But here we are. So when the lovers swear to be true, Troilus is swearing that he will be true and future men will be, quote, as true as Troilus. And Cressida is swearing that if she is false, bad things will happen and future women will be as false as Cressid, as it says. Why is it phrased in this way? Like, why wouldn't they both swear to be loyal, but we have to immediately go to, like, a negative? Which, like, yeah, I swear to not be false. Using Lytodes there. Why did he do that? Is that just like we're foreshadowing, we know it's happening, so we're going to play into that? Or is that going again to sort of this, the sexism that we're seeing in this play?
I was just going to chalk it up to foreshadowing, okay, and that there's maybe a poetic purpose for the juxtaposition of the two different ways of expressing it. You know, like it's almost like a poetic device. I don't think the misogyny and sexism is fully there. Mm-hmm. And maybe if people had known the story, it is a little bit of dramatic irony. In the same way her father is like, you know, may I become the one who was known as, you know, pandering, whatever. So I don't think it's full misogyny on display. I think it's more of a foreshadowing slash a little bit of irony and poetic juxtaposition.
Yeah. I guess at that point, because I didn't know it was going to happen, I was frustrated with it because I just wanted them both to swear to be true. But then it didn't turn out like that. And so now it's just like, you know, people could be, I don't think people are so referring to other people like this, but just, you know, you could be considered a Helen. You could also be considered a Cressida. Could you imagine talking to someone like that? Just be like, you're such a Cressida if someone betrays you, which is just nuts and unfortunate. Yeah.
I don't think this play, I don't think the story gets referenced very much these days, to be completely honest with you. I think the character that people will often bust out when they're talking about the wanton woman would be probably Jezebel. So I don't see a lot of reference to Troilus and Cressida these days. Yeah. Not even in our popular culture.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't know it existed, so makes sense. Mm-hmm. Why... In one of the most cringeworthy scenes, I think, that I read. To be honest, like, I wish I could have taken a picture of my face because it was definitely, like, scowling and just super confused. Why this kiss scene? Is it just for Ulysses to prove that Cressida and the audience to understand that Cressida is really pushing us, really hitting us over the head there, Shakespeare, that Cressida is a false and loose woman and wanton? Or is there something else going on? Like, why? Why does the scene exist? Yeah, please read us, narrate this kissing scene for us, Tom. It were no match, your nail against his horn. May I, sweet lady, beg a kiss of you? You may. I do desire it. Why beg, then? Why, then, for Venus's sake, give me a kiss, when Helen is a maid again and his. I am your debtor. Claim it when 'tis due. Never's my day. And then a kiss of you. Oh, yeah. Even above it. Yeah, the first was Menelaus's kiss. This mine. Patroclus kisses you. Oh, this is trim. Paris and I kiss evermore for him. I'll have my kiss, sir. Lady, by your leave. That was Menelaus. In kissing, do you render or receive? Yeah, it's... Why?
Yeah, it is really, really... It's such a weird scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so, so strange. I don't even know how to explain it.
I wouldn't.
Why, yeah, why he would write that in.
Which, that potentially points to just, you know, Ulysses being an antagonist in how he does that. Yeah, just like toxic behavior. I don't know. Again, I was so confused, like, why this was happening, why she would be willing to do this, thinking that, you know, is she going to be a prisoner in this particular camp, but is willing to kiss them, was just so odd for me. Yeah. I don't even know that I can, like, empathetically understand what's going on here.
Because at first glance, it comes off as they're doing this, and it seems, like, assaulting, in a sense.
Yep.
And... to perhaps degrade her and make her realize in their eyes, I'm putting quotes up to the mic here, that she's property and not a woman. Like, you know, she was a prisoner exchange. She is not to dehumanize her or something. It's a very cruel, sexist, misogynist thing to do. But the way Shakespeare has it done, she's not, I don't want to say she's enjoying it, but she's like, there's like all this witty exchange that it doesn't match up with what they're trying to do. Again, maybe he was going, I just think maybe it just, I think just things aren't landing the way they would in other plays and things like that. So, you know.
Yeah. When she's in the tent with Diomedes and sort of this back and forth and pushing him away and pulling him towards her, is she protecting herself? Or do you think she really is betraying Troilus?
I thought she was at first. And then I kind of think that she's also the way Shakespeare's portraying, she actually does like it. She likes the attention, and she's just kind of playing hard to get. We also don't know what's in the letter,
right?
Do we?
No, is that she gives Troilus. No.
Yeah, is the letter a Dear John letter?
Ooh.
Or is it a this is what I have to do letter? Kind of like explaining the purpose of I fear for my life. And sort of like I am a prisoner and I have but no choice to be with to lay with this man. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
But considering the way he portrayed Helen, I would say that he's just got her like, you know, ooh, this big Greek man, and she's it's a, pardon the pun, kiss off, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he is saying something about, yeah. It, had we known it was in the letter, it'd be a little bit easier, and he's kind of leaving it up to us to interpret. But he doesn't really earn anything out of every other part of this plot that we would be that intrigued to figure out, like, you know, did she really love him or not? And maybe that's what he was trying to get us to do. But again, because it doesn't really land very well, it's mm-hmm. It's more aggravating than it is intriguing.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I keep going back just with what I thought was going to happen, because it's very much, yeah. It's almost like when we did Pet Sematary, where I thought that it was going to be one thing and it turned out to be quite another thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where I thought that this was, yeah, going to be the struggle where this woman is trying to remain faithful, but also, you know, she's in an enemy camp and what is that like? Which I'd be down for that story, but this is not what we have here. But I was, it sort of reminds me of The Nightingale, Nightingale by Kristen Hanna, where one of the sisters has to host a Nazi officer, mm-hmm. and because it's in World War II in France, mm-hmm. and you know, people kind of look down on her because I think there was an affair of some sort for, you know, having this person not resisting. But you have to understand, like, when you're in this particular situation, like, you can resist, yes, which might mean death. Or you can, like, try to protect yourself. And I think she had kids there. It's been a little while. And go along with, you know, what the officer is telling her for the safety of everyone involved. And that is what I had in the best of ways imagined with Cressida.
Yeah.
That is what I would have hoped for, that, you know, she is in this enemy situation. Here is this lieutenant or general that is paying me attention. I have two options here. Both of them probably will involve me being taken in a bad way. But will it be, it's like the easier being taken or the harder being taken is sort of what I saw. But this, it's interesting, you know, her giving the token that Troilus gave her is perhaps the most damning part of it all. Because I feel mm-hmm. like I could say that, oh, she's playing him, but not too much, like keeping herself safe. But then why would you give somebody a token that another person gave you? And he was going to wear it on the battlefield, and then Troilus is going to see it? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, that's because I can understand holding on to the token and taking it out because I'm going to remember you, and I'm holding mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. as a romantic gesture of faithfulness. That is the betrayal, yeah. right? More than anything. Yeah. And then Diomedes wearing it on the battlefield is just bragging.
Mm-hmm.
It's rubbing him in it. He's basically, that is emasculating Troilus.
Mm-hmm.
And again, neither of them die. Not that you have to die, but I mean, it's just weird how, like, you'd expect Troilus to go nuts and kill Diomedes,
right.
or
yeah.
Troilus to the tragic thing of this, if Troilus is the sad character, to Troilus to die at the hands of his lover's new man,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not, it doesn't really seem to happen.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, the play ends with the death of Hector,
mm-hmm.
but Pandarus is the final speaker, sort of bemoaning his lot in life. I guess I did what was asked of me. Why am I the bad guy? What is the effect of this? These two things that don't necessarily go together and are almost at odds with one another. Because you have this honorable man who has been killed, and you have this man who believes that he was acting honorably but really wasn't and kind of gets his just desserts.
Yeah. I just wonder, is this Shakespeare trying to give the play a moral? Because Pandarus is like one of the more reprehensible characters in the play.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole idea of pandering, et cetera. So it's, yeah. is he making a moral statement here by having Pandarus do that? Because like at the end of some of his other plays, he has a character monologue us out. Like the prince in Romeo and Juliet. Mm. Never was there a tale more woe of Juliet and her Romeo, however it goes. Which is the prince is the outsider, right? And he's coming in. He's the whole time he's in the play, he's always the outside observer. And he, of course, he is the catalyst for the death penalty thing in there. But he's always commenting on this feud between the Montagues and the Capulets. Or like the song at the end of Twelfth Night, Hey Ho, Wind in the Rain, that kind of recaps the play for us. And then I think it's Puck gives the last speech in Midsummer Night's Dream, right? If we spirits have offended, I think that's the line or something like that. But so it's a common Shakespeare thing of somebody giving a speech at the end of a play to close things out and wrap things up. And maybe this is Pandarus giving this sort of moral lesson to us. But again, by that point, I'm just like, the lesson is the play's over.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about Hamlet's end as well. I just feel like this is the last man that I would like to hear from.
Yeah.
To be honest, I'm surprised it wasn't Ulysses, because I think Ulysses, I think people over in the Greek camp would 100% and do 100% recognize the importance of and the valor of and the virtue of Hector. Mm-hmm. And to have something like that and talk to him or talk about him, you know, that Troy lost a prince or Priam coming out on stage, but instead we have this, which goes back to Cressida and Troilus, which is a bit, I just don't know. I mean, the word for this of the day for this play is nuts. Yeah, because at least with the source material, when Hector dies and you've got the funeral games, which is how we end it.
The funeral Olympics, you mean?
Yes, the funeral Olympics, yeah. But death is still ever present, but you sort of have this break in all the slaughter, this momentary peace. But here it's ends with Hector. I mean, yeah, I don't know why Pandarus, of all people, would be the one. Because he doesn't even really interact with Hector. Like, maybe he spoke to him once, but that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think that's just the messed up like attempt at blending the political and romantic plot together that didn't really work.
Mm-hmm. And it's Shakespeare using a typical device of his.
Yeah.
Too. Which, because I know we're kind of at the end of the questions and stuff, but you had skipped one.
I do want to talk about him. Yeah.
So why don't you bring him in? Because I actually think I do know the answer to this.
Yeah. So Thersites. Whatever.
Thersites,
yeah. Yeah, I'd like to investigate his character and his purpose.
He is the fool.
Okay.
Shakespeare has the fool, and the purpose of the fool is to call everybody else around him a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. Thank you, Dr. Shy, my junior year Shakespeare teacher, who did the comedies with us, and he always pointed out you have Feste and Falstaff and all these characters, and there are clowns. Sometimes they're literally a clown, especially in the comedies, and they're almost this weird voice of reason while also being like silly, because everybody around them is acting like an idiot, and they're always pointing out that people are idiots. So he's calling out Patroclus and Achilles and stuff like that, etc. Like literally saying, Agamemnon is a fool, Achilles is a fool, Thersites is a fool, as for said Patroclus is a fool. And so he's there for comic relief, but he's also there to point out the foolish behavior of other things. And that's a character trope that Shakespeare used a lot. So like I said, when I was saying earlier, like I thought he was taking a story that he like really wanted to tell and throwing all of his tricks at it, this is another one of those tricks. Doesn't necessarily work all the time, but I think that's what I think it is.
Yeah, I initially, when he first came out, I thought that he was the fool, and that he was the quote-unquote comedic relief. But I feel like, so I think yes, and the way he speaks for me is unlike any other fool that I have read. because it's just so biting. And I think that it, less than making jokes, like, he literally is pointing out all the terrible things that are going on now and how these people are acting, and that there's a lack of honor and virtue throughout the Greek camp. So if there's any commentary, I feel like it's coming from him. But he is probably the meanest fool that I think I've ever read. Would you agree with that? Or do you feel like you say with the ones that you have mentioned, do you think tonally those speak the same way? Because this just felt different to me.
I agree with you. I'm looking, sorry, I'm flipping back through the book because the play, at least in the Norton, right before this, and pages are stuck together. It's Norton Anthologies of Literature on that, like, really thin onion skin paper, like the Bibles paper. Yeah. So they're like these tiny thin pages. There's like a second fool in Twelfth Night who participates in the prank against Malvolio, and like when they take it too far. And one of the reasons they created that character was because the actor who played Festy didn't want to play somebody so vulgar. And I want to say it's Fabian, but I'm not entirely sure that's who it is. But I think it is Fabian. And so I think that that's kind of who I thought of, where it's like, you know, I'm going to create this like kind of lesser fool who's a little more crass. Rather than the higher wit of my Festy character. That's the only real equivalent I can have, and the only reason I bring it up is, besides the fact that I love the play, it's the play that, at least as far as how they've ordered this, is right before Troilus and Cressida. So I don't know if they were produced like very close to one another and Shakespeare was just kind of rolling another thing from another play, because he did that before, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are in some way or another kind of overlap when it comes to Romeo and Juliet and A Midsummer Night's Dream in some ways and things like that, because they talked about it's been written, like, did he write them both at the same time, and they kind of bleed into each other in some regard of star-crossed lovers and these sorts of things. And maybe this bled into that a little bit, at least as far as this type of character, or he liked the type of character, or he thought it would work here because he's trying to do commentary, and again, it just doesn't, it gets mean.
Yeah.
In a big way, especially when he's dealing when he's making smart remarks about Troilus and Cressida during that, what's essentially a balcony scene, right? Even though it's a tent scene. And I think he's trying to get, maybe he's the audience commentary, he's the character who's kind of breaking the fourth wall, look at these idiots, that sort of thing. And it doesn't. It comes off as mean more than funny.
Yeah, and I feel like only certain characters, like maybe Achilles, deserves that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that everyone does.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just kind of goes against, like, the Greek ideals. I think if this character actually existed and spoke the way that he did in the Iliad, I feel like he would be killed by the Greeks.
Well, if this were satirical in nature or meant to be a criticism, like a critical piece or something like that, a cultural criticism, and Thersites is that voice of reason and criticism, Shakespeare speaking through that character, that would work. But there's not enough to suggest that that's correct.
Mm. Any other thoughts or things you would like to discuss?
No, I just feel bad that we just kind of like ripped this play.
I think it was bound to happen sometime. I am surprised that it was a Shakespeare play we did it to.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's our honest opinion. And yeah. I really do dare someone to read it and tell us otherwise. I think it has its merits, but
yeah.
He needed to choose one plot and stick with it.
Yeah.
And there are just things that I do not agree with. And obviously I'm living 400 years after him, and so I'm a armchair critic of it. But yeah, I just honestly didn't think that it was very good. So I do have two questions,
sure.
Obviously, since we have a crossover. So for Dear Reader, I like to ask whether an adaptation is in the spirit of the original, in the spirit of the Iliad, or in the law of the Iliad. So how closely does it follow it? Do you have a thought on this?
I think it takes a lot of liberties with things. It follows in a rough way. It follows the Iliad, and certain events do happen, even if they're not portrayed as well as they are in the Iliad. You know, Hector does die. Achilles does drag him around. Patroclus dies, and Achilles goes into battle. So there's like, it's like a rough representation of it, but it doesn't. Shakespeare doesn't necessarily keep the, doesn't adhere to it as law.
Right.
Certainly, spirit of. Maybe I don't know what the perception of the story of the Iliad was back in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this is in the spirit of the Iliad as it was perceived back then.
Yeah.
But as we perceive the Iliad now, and having read it ourselves a few months ago, mm-hmm. I'm going to say in some beats it is, but for the most part it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely not the law of the Iliad. Yeah, general plot points, as you said, more or less the characters, but yes, it's more spirit than law, if that's my binary choice.
Yeah,
to be sure. And then of course the other question is this required reading?
No.
I agree with you. In fact, I would say if you're looking for a Shakespeare play, that this is not the one.
No.
go somewhere else.
this is a completist.
Yes.
Shakespeare play, yeah. Right? That, yeah. I can't even say this is a deep cut, and this is a completist play.
Yes. Yeah, Tom and I read this so that you do not have to.
Exactly.
And we gave you a nice synopsis and everything. So thank you, Tom, for suffering through that with me. I know that the next one. Well, I mean, I hope I'm like optimistically like, I know the next one that we are going to hopefully really like.
Yeah, we are looking forward to that.
Yes.
I guess I should say what it is.
Oh, really? No feedback?
We probably do. I didn't get a chance to put it
in. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, so we'll hold feedback until next episode.
Next time.
We have a couple of, because we're recording this before episode 100 drops. Episode 100 is going to drop the following week after we record this. So I was going to wait to get some 100 feedback, and then in 102 we'll drop all the feedback we've gotten over the last few months, because I'm curious as to what people are going to think or say about episode 100.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can come back next month to see what people had to say.
Okay.
But I will say this is the second time around that we are going to be, the third time, because we've done three novels that have been released like literally just around the time we covered them. One of them was Helena Greer's Season of Love, which we had her on. We talked about the romance novel around Christmas, lesbian romance novel around Christmas. But the other one was the prior book to this one, because arriving, according to what I'm looking at my iPad here, said arriving Tuesday on the 18th, which might be, you know, a little quicker, is Sunrise on the Reaping by Suzanne Collins, which is the next in the series of this Hunger Games prequel that started with The Ballad of the Songbirds and Snakes that we covered a few years ago when it came out, you know, just as it came out. So this is a completely new, but literally a completely new book for everybody involved. And I've been looking forward to this ever since it was announced, that because I really did like the other one, and I know you did too. So this will be fun.
Yeah, and everybody, I think, is dying to know about Haymitch's Games.
Yeah.
I saw a reel today about basically like people excited for Haymitch's Games, but also about to be killed, probably because Haymitch like falls in love with somebody and that person dies and it's heartbreaking. So it's like, I'm sure we're going to have hills and valleys with this novel. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Is it the 50th or is it a quarter quell? Because wasn't it a big one?
Catching Fire is a quarter quell.
Okay. So
it's the 75th.
So it might be 50.
It has to be something, because if it was the 25th, he would have been too old.
Yeah.
So I think it was the 50th.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, it was like the 10th at that point, right?
Yeah.
roughly
switching things up. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious, is like with Haymitch is it being, if Haymitch is a main character, is the main character, how that will play out. And that'll be really interesting. These origin stories of these characters that we've known for many books, and we'll eventually get around to the other two in the Hunger Games series, by the way.
Yeah.
Catching Fire is sitting there. We're both like, we both really should cover that book, because I do remember really liking that book. Mm-hmm. Mockingjay was a bit of a chore, but I did enjoy that in the end. So Mockingjay just starts off really, really slowly. Mm. So I did not need to be two movies, but that's a whole other conversation to have. Yeah, so that's pretty much it. So we are out there. You can email us about whether or not you even dare try Troilus and Cressida. And if you're looking for us, to email us for required reading, it's requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We are on Blue Sky instead of Twitter, and we are Required Reading Cast on Blue Sky. You can find us there on the socials. Of course, we're also on Facebook still too. So yeah, so we hope everybody is doing well and has not decided to rage quit our podcast. As always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And you know, if someone makes a pledge of love to you and fidelity to you, you should also say, I pledge fidelity to you. So don't try to be clever and bait saying, I'm not going to be false to you, okay? Just be straightforward.
If I screw up, you can hate me.
Oh, my.
No. That's not the best way to do it. Good night.
Yeah, good night. Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.